The Pat Kenny Show
with Timber Living Log Cabins.
Saturday and Sunday from 10 a.m. on News Talk. Conversation that counts.
Is sacrificing one life justified in order to save the lives of others? A newly published book, The Captain's Dinner, focuses on events surrounding the 1884 voyage of the Mignonette and the subsequent trial for murder of some of its four-man crew. Now, to talk about the grisly detail of those events and their far-reaching consequences, we're joined by the book's author, Adam Cohn. Adam, good morning and welcome.
Good morning.
Now, you might tell us the story of the Mignonette. It was not sailed by an owner, but rather by a hired crew. So how did the voyage come about?
Yes, that's correct. A lawyer in Australia bought a yacht in London, a used yacht, and he needed to have it delivered to him in Sydney. A captain and three sailors were hired, and they began sailing from Falmouth, from England to Australia. And they made it as far as the equator pretty well, but then things did fall apart.
Now, the weather turned against them, and the boat sank, and they were adrift in a tiny vessel.
That's correct. There was a small wooden lifeboat, and the four men did manage to escape from the yacht, and they were in the lifeboat, and they were able to survive in it, except for one thing. They really had virtually no food, just two cans of turnip and no water. So it became a problem very quickly for them.
Now, you might profile the members of this motley crew. There were four on board. There was a captain, and who else?
Yeah, that's correct. Captain Dudley, and then he had a first mate, Stevens. Then there was a sailor named Brooks, and then there was a 17-year-old orphan cabin boy named Richard Parker, who becomes very important, unfortunately, to the story.
Now, things were going badly for them. They managed to get some nourishment from a sea turtle they caught and devoured, but then hunger was getting to them, and they knew that they perhaps would all perish from hunger.
That's correct. And, you know, even more thirst. You know, they tried to catch water in their raincoats when it rained, but didn't do a very good job of that. It was very difficult. And actually, you do die first of thirst rather than hunger. So it was really thirst that made them take some rather desperate measures.
Now, your book discusses an age-old sea tradition, which was, in extremis, that crew members might devour one of their fellows.
Correct. Called the custom of the sea. There's actually a long history of it. It's in literature as well as in real life, going back many centuries. It's in Lord Byron's Don Juan. So that was the understanding, is that in extreme circumstances, you could actually draw straws and choose who would be killed and eaten. They didn't actually draw straws this time, but they did the other part of it.
Now, the problem was that you had Richard Parker, who was the cabin boy. He was the youngest. He also had taken up too much seawater. He tried to drink seawater in spite of being told not to by the other crew members. It would only do him harm. So he was weakening.
That's correct. He was the sickest of the four, and the captain did say, oh, you know, he's so sick, he's on death's door, but he actually wasn't that sick. He was the sickest, but he was doing okay, and every morning, little Richard Parker woke up saying, perhaps today is the day we will see a ship. So he certainly thought he had a good chance of surviving.
Now, the standpoint of the others, when it came to deciding, and they did, that Richard Parker would be killed and eaten, were they all at one with this decision?
No, and it's actually quite fascinating that the captain made the decision early on, wanted to do it, wanted to convince the others. Stevens, his first mate, was reluctant at first, but went along. Brooks, the third one, never went along. He did not believe it was right. He said, I do not want to kill. I do not want to be killed. He would rather just wait to see if a ship came along or if they found land. So he did not want to participate.
I mean, you contrast the attitudes of Dudley, first of all, and Stevens went along with him. The act was absolutely necessary to sustain the existence of those remaining, said he. But Brooks, who you describe as the moral center of the book, his attitude was, let us all die together.
That's right. Or let us all try to live together without killing. And, you know, as it turned out, it was only a few more days before a ship did come along, and it did rain a couple days later. So Brooks might have been right that they could have survived without killing Parker, but we'll never know because, as we know, they did kill Parker.
Now, how were they rescued? What kind of a vessel came upon them?
It was very fortunate that in a place where there were not many ships, a German ship was passing by, and the captain very kindly saw them and also stopped, took them on, and then also returned them to Falmouth, England. So it was very fortunate that not only a big ship with a lot of food and all that came along, but one that was willing to go out of its way to save the men.
Now, when they got back, the three survivors got back, they, I'm not sure if they expected a hero's welcome, but they certainly expected a welcome and not arrest and apprehension.
Correct. And I think Dudley was ready to tell some great stories. He took some souvenirs. He made sure to take the lifeboat back with him. He was ready to be sort of the center of attention in all this. And he did wire his wife when they arrived and said he'd be home soon. He just had to answer some questions. And then they were shocked to be arrested and put in jail in Falmouth and suddenly charged with murder.
Now, you say that this particular time in Victorian England was just a bad time to be a cannibal. Why?
Well, a couple of reasons. One is there was this Victorian reform movement going on. So the reformers in England were changing everything. They were expanding the right to vote to the middle class. They were regulating factories. They were trying to make England much better. And eventually they got around to this custom of the sea and they decided this is not a good practice. The other thing, though, is that it was the year in which England really began to wrestle with its colonial history. A year before, the most prominent historian in England wrote a book in which he said that England had acquired colonies in a fit of absent-mindedness, and it caused this national discussion about why do we have an empire? And one of the things people thought is we had an empire to lift up the rest of the world. Well, when you lift up the rest of the world, one thing you do is you stop them from becoming cannibals. So it's a very bad year, 1884, for three Englishmen to say, oh, by the way, we're English and we're cannibals. No one, you know, people didn't like that.
So these men, two of the three were charged with murder. Brooks was not. So clearly, the statements of the other two vindicated Brooks.
Yeah, well, Dudley, the captain, kind of was a little vague at first in his written statements, even about who was involved in it. But yes, eventually everyone did agree that Brooks did not participate. And what happened, though, is Brooks actually became the lead witness for the prosecution.
Mm-hmm. Now, the interesting about this case is that the facts were not contested. I mean, Richard Parker was killed by those on board and was eaten by those on board. So everyone agreed to that. So the real question was, does necessity justify murder or does it never justify murder? So which court got to decide?
Well, it eventually made its way up to the highest court, to the Lord Chief Justice and a specially assembled panel of some of the highest judges in England. And they had to address that exact question that you mentioned. Does English law allow a necessity defense, saying we committed a murder, but it was to avoid a greater harm, three people dying? And that was the decision that they had to come to.
And then the central conclusion was necessity is not a defense to murder.
That's right. So after centuries of the courts never prosecuting anyone for the custom of the sea, this was the year in 1884 when they said, you can't do this. If you are going to kill the cabin boy and kill and eat him, that is murder and you will be punished as a murderer.
Now, Stevens and Dudley, the captain and the first mate, they were responsible for the death of Parker. But Brooks, who even covered his face when this foul act was happening, he did relish and enjoy the proceeds of their murder.
Yes, he did. As soon as Parker was killed, Brooks did ask if he could have some of the blood to drink, and he got a little, although it was fairly congealed. He did eat as well. But that really is a very different moral matter, I think, because it actually wasn't a crime to eat raw flesh. It's not the cannibalism that was the crime. It was the murder, the taking of a life.
How did they all fare afterwards? I mean, the penalty for death in those days was execution by hanging. They weren't hanged, were they?
No, they were sentenced to be hanged by the Lord Chief Justice, but the Queen pardoned them on the recommendation of the Home Secretary, and they only served 6 months in prison. But their lives were kind of haunted by the case. They didn't rest easy, as it were.
And how do they all fare? I mean, do they live to ripe old ages, or do they turn to the demon drink, or what happened to them?
Well, interestingly, Brooks and Stevens lived to fairly ripe old ages, but they were haunted by the case. Dudley, the captain, went to Australia, and as it happened, he set up a very successful successful shipping shop there. But he became the first victim in Australia of the bubonic plague that broke out in the early 1900s. So he died a rather painful and ignominious death, as it turned out.
Now, this sentence from the Lord Chief Justice resonates right down to the present day. It is a defining principle in certainly English law and probably translated into other legal systems.
That's right. And, you know, ultimately, you know, this case is taught a lot in philosophy classes because it's ultimately the war between utilitarians who say, do whatever, you know, is the greatest good for the greatest number. And then people who are more rights-based in their theories of justice and say, no, there are certain things that are just inherently wrong, like murder. And people like Richard Parker have the right to live. And yeah, that idea about the right to live and rights being more important in many cases than utilitarianism, that is the spirit of this case, which really has been strong ever since.
Now, this has resonances right to this day because you have the contradiction of this principle being espoused by Donald Trump in terms of bombing the boats off the coast of Venezuela at the time when he claimed there was drug running to America that was killing hundreds and hundreds of American citizens every year. And the justification was, well, maybe they're fishermen, maybe they're not, maybe they're drug runners, but by bombing these boats, we save American lives.
Yes, that's one case in which our president is, I would say, far too utilitarian in that. And it comes up in a lot of other contexts, too. One I write about is in the distribution of ventilators at the start of COVID. The British Union of Doctors said, take the ventilators away from people who are using them if you find someone who could have a better chance of living. And there was a British medical ethicist cited this case to say, no, you don't do that. The person who's on the ventilator has a right to try to keep living. You don't be utilitarian. Try to think about the individual lives involved.
And this principle, obviously, it was espoused by the Lord Chief Justice then. But looking at the modern era, when, you know, right from, I suppose, the First World War through to the times we're living through now, the killing of civilians seemed to have been, you know, something that was no longer seen as anathema to warring parties.
Right. It's always an issue in war and in other contexts as well. You know, how do you calculate when it's worth taking a life in order to achieve some greater goal? And you see it a lot also in totalitarian regimes, right? Stalin and Mao and people like that always, as the bodies piled up, said it's to build a better world, a greater world. But we have to be really skeptical about killing a lot of people to build a, quote, greater world.
I should mention that you're the author of a book called Supreme Inequality, the Supreme Court's 50-year battle for a more unjust America. And it looks like it might be succeeding in its battle.
Yes, it was succeeding a few years ago when I wrote the book, and it's even succeeding more now. Absolutely. And, you know, in America, we're raised to believe that the Supreme Court is the bastion of justice, the institution that's going to make sure everything in our society is fair and right. And as I argue in the book, it actually has made things more unequal. It's issued rulings allowing rich people to spend unlimited amounts of money on campaigns and things like that. So it's been a force in the wrong direction, and I do call it out for that.
And does it mean that the U.S. Constitution, which is regarded as sacrosanct with a few amendments along the way, that it really is not a document that is fit for the modern age?
You know, we love our Constitution. It's all a matter of how it's interpreted. The problem is that right now we have a very right-wing court. You know, Trump has gotten a number of bad appointments in recent years. With the right Supreme Court, I think our Constitution is amazing, but it can be interpreted in bad ways, which is what has been happening.
And there is no sanction, it would appear, for a Supreme Court judge who might be, shall we say, on the take?
Well, there's always been some issues of that with a few of them, and they don't have very strong ethics rules. That's true. But I think the larger problem is just that a lot of them have a really bad ideology, an ideology about always siding with the powerful against the weak in many contexts. And that's what we'd like to change. And we need some better court appointments in the next few years to change that.
Time will tell. But the current book, The Captain's Dinner, is absolutely brilliant. It has a recommendation from none other than the former Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, who enjoyed it thoroughly, as did I. Captain's Dinner, it's called, and its author, Adam Cohen. Adam, thank you.
The Pat Kenny Show on News Talk
with Timber Living Log Cabins.